Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 155, recorded Friday, September 20th, 2019. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. One topic on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast, street food in Poland and Hungary. So coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios in Chicago, Illinois, on an off travel week, taking a break this week after a couple of weeks of weather-induced hassles, that in spite of completely avoiding Hurricane Dorian. Instead, it's been a steady stream of morning thunderstorms hitting O'Hare and just jacking it up for the rest of the day. That and flying regional jets, which we've talked about before, are often problematic. In the last episode, I talked about having to shift my outbound evening flight from going to Charlottesville to going to Richmond, Virginia, because of morning thunderstorms at O'Hare. These last 2 weeks have just been different variations on that same theme. The Tuesday after Labor Day, I was on the bus to the L heading to O'Hare for an 8 a.m. flight because, of course, Uber and Lyft wait times were insane. I got to tell you, one of the things about moving downtown, I really miss my Mongolian ex taxi driver who would always pick me up. Well, anyhow, I'm on the bus and I get a text that my American Eagle flight was canceled. So still on the bus, I called American's Platinum Line. They told me what I already knew, that no other American options, you know, until the end of the day. And I told them that, you know, since I was coming home the next day, Wednesday, I needed to get to Charlottesville that morning. So what about the 9 a.m. United flight? I asked the agent. I'm already on my way to O'Hare. Well, let me call United to transfer the ticket, she offered. Now, I have to tell you, just that simple thing, I was just pleasantly surprising. I mean, over the past few years, I've seen airlines more and more reluctant to lose revenue by moving you to another carrier. But really, there was none of that coming from this American agent. Our call kept going as I got off the bus and walked down the stairs into the subway stop. But she got everything squared away. Now, that United flight also was delayed. It ended up being delayed about an hour, but at least it got me to Charlottesville before lunchtime. Now, last Friday morning, a week ago, in Charlottesville, I woke up and sort of scrolled through my Twitter and saw the handle NWS Chicago, which is the National Weather Service, tweeting about severe thunderstorms. So when I got the text from United at 9 a.m. delaying my 1 p.m. flight home, it was delayed by 45 minutes, I wasn't all that surprised. And really no big deal. I'll just get a second beer at the radar bar. But then, as these things tend to do, it didn't stop there. An hour later, another text from United. The delay doubled to 90 minutes. But then at noon, another text. The delay was down to an hour. Shortly followed by another text, it was back up to 90 minutes. So I pull up FlightAware. Look, I'm not going to the airport until the inbound plane leaves the gate at O'Hare. 10 minutes later, I see it push back. All right, that ought to be the end, then, I think, of the delay cascade. I order an Uber, head to the airport. Halfway to the airport, I get another text. Now my flight isn't leaving until 3:30 p.m., 2.5 hours late, immediately followed by a text with a 3:57 departure time. I get out of the car, head to the gate agent. What is going on? I mean, has the plane left O'Hare yet? Now, unlike the American agent, the United agent, or maybe she worked for Air Wisconsin, the United Express partner, I don't know, she's being a bit evasive. So, you know, don't know what's going on, no other options, everything else is oversold, even in Richmond. I get out of the line and call United's premier desk. Yes, there's availability out of Richmond and out of DC. Now, Richmond's a little bit closer, but it's got a hell of a lot less of a rush hour. So I move over to the Richmond 5:30 flight, the United agent telling me, I think you're making the right decision. I book a one-way rental and then head out to the parking lot. There's a mist starting to settle in over the Charlottesville airport. This this is just can't be good. So it's an uneventful 90-minute drive to Richmond. I sit at the Sam Adams Brew House and have a beer and then another beer. This flight, the United flight from Richmond, leaves on time. It's also a regional jet, but it's been running up and down the East Coast. So at least for today, it's running on time. And it gets me into O'Hare at 6:50 p.m., about 5 hours after my original flight was supposed to land. I fire up the United app and look at the status of that original flight. It still hasn't left. It actually didn't leave until 9 p.m. that night. And then it only made it as far as Washington Dulles Airport, about 95 miles up the road. So following up, in contrast to my regional jet challenges, our trip, Irene's and my trip at the end of August to Krakow and Budapest went much smoother. We flew LOT, the Polish airline, the whole way, including the last leg, the Budapest to O'Hare nonstop leg. I was kind of surprised by that leg, a transatlantic leg that didn't go through Poland. But there must be enough traffic on that route. A week before we left, American announced their own nonstop between O'Hare and Budapest starting next year. Both airlines present tense, future tense, use 787s on the route. And perhaps, you know, this O'Hare to Budapest route is one of those long, thin routes that the 787 was designed to unlock. All three flights on LOT, the 787s on the long legs and a Dash 8 prop job on the hop from Krakow to Budapest, I mean, they were very reasonable. They were fine. They were reasonable flights. I thought the 787s, a morning wake-up mode for breakfast when the cabin lights sort of fade up while the darkened windows lighten because there's no pull-down shades on the windows in the 787, just the actual window itself kind of darkens and lightens. So, you know, having that kind of a little bit mellower wake-up mode was a pleasant change to the usual boom, lights on and PA announcement approach. Actually, this was my first trip to Poland. Krakow Airport was nice. It was new, compact, with a train station in the city. Good trips on LOT. I can't say anything bad about it. I talked in the last episode about trying out my iPhone's XS dual SIM capability in Hungary and Poland. I did the pre-work before I left, working through a couple of chat sessions to move my US AT&T number over to the internal eSIM so that I could use the one physical SIM slot for my UK EE prepaid SIM. En route then, you know, in that LOT 787, probably somewhere over the Faroe Islands, I think, I went into settings on my iPhone and made the UK line, that double E line, the main voice and data line, leaving my US line open for phone calls and text. I mean, it seemed to work as designed. I replied to a couple of texts on my US line that I'd gotten from my sister. But, you know, it looks like everything else went out over the UK line with the 3 gigabyte for £10 plan. Now, I'll hold final judgment until I get this month's bill from AT&T. But from what I could see on their website, it looks like it worked. It was a nice change, you know, having just the one phone and not having to remember to check my other phone every night. The new version of the iPhone operating system, iOS 13, that came out, I think, yesterday, is supposed to have some improvements for dual SIM. But I got to tell you, I was happy with what I used in August. But check back with me, you know, after I get my AT&T bill. And of course, you know, I extend those 3 gigabytes when I'm traveling by hitting the Wi-Fis in coffee shops and hotels, which is where we circle back to one of my top security tips always: use a VPN when on Wi-Fi. Now, I used to think that as long as I was hitting encrypted websites, I was okay. It used to be that you'd see actually the HTTPS in the address bar, but apparently Apple and Google think that that's too much for us to process, so they've replaced it with the picture of a lock. Firefox still shows the full address, though. But it seems that more and more security breaches are taking advantage of sort of obscure misconfigurations that get around even some of this basic security. And I have to tell you, with major hotel chains regularly coughing up millions of credit card numbers due to hacks and misconfigurations, it kind of seems to me a bit unreasonable to expect the staff of a small coffee shop or some local mom and pop hotel to be, you know, completely up to date on their router patching. So I have VPN clients on my iPhone, my Android tablet, my MacBook Air. Now, I have to tell you, I usually forget to turn them on if I'm doing a quick check of Twitter or Google Maps while in line somewhere. But if I'm doing any sort of browsing session on public Wi-Fi these days, and quite honestly, not just in Europe, but, you know, even in the U.S., I'll fire that VPN right up. Packing for this trip meant rummaging around for European plug adapters. Now, not voltage converters. I don't use them because all the electronics can handle anything from 110 to 240 volts. But, you know, I'm just talking about the plug adapters, going from the U.S. two blade plugs to the European two round plug adapters. Now, I'd rounded up all my U.K. adapters for our June trip to Ireland and Scotland, but now I needed, you know, those European adapters, those two round plugs. Now, you know, so rummaging around in my bin, I found the UK adapters and kind of a random South African one and a random Indian one, but I couldn't find the European ones anywhere, probably because I'd left them all behind in Brittany and Marsh. So I got on Amazon, as one does when they need some random things in a hurry, and ordered just a box of six. I only needed one, maybe two, but given my history, I figured six would keep me good for a year or two. So I ordered white adapters, quite honestly, because that's what popped up on Amazon, which is okay in those hotels with black outlets, but not so great for those hotels with white outlets. So I took two and actually came home with two, pleasantly surprised. But I have to tell you, it was only by sheer luck. At least twice, I was walking out of the room, wheeling my bag out to go check out. And only then, with a back glance into the room, did I notice, you know, an adapter still plugged in, hiding in a recessed white outlet. I have to tell you, I think what it is, I just, you know, really need colored plug adapters and not sort of tasteful colors. I mean, something gaudy like purple or pink or chartreuse. I don't know. Maybe I'll spray paint the ones I've got before my next trip. Leonard, with no last name, commented on the last episode with a link, and this was, he left a comment on the website, with a link to a Dallas TV station's coverage of the last American Airlines MD-80 flight, appropriately flying from DFW to O'Hare, a route and a plane that contributed heavily to my first Advantage Gold status, which at that time was the highest level back in 1985. That is, there's been a lot of stories covering the retirement. We've talked about it on previous podcasts. People sort of waxing nostalgic, though not too much, since I haven't heard of any big jump in Delta's MD-80 bookings. They still fly about 100 of them. I have seen a couple of quotes, though, about not wanting to sit in the last rows because of the noise from the side-mounted engines. And I have to tell you, for me, not even those Bose noise-canceling headphones could cancel all the engine and vibration noise. They were also bad seats because there were no windows, which, I mean, kind of made sense because all you'd see would be the engine cowling, and the window would then make the noise even worse. And those times when I ended up in those seats, usually last-minute bookings between O'Hare and DFW, my mind would, I don't know, sometimes wander. What would happen if the engine next to my head blows up? Will the shrapnel blow out into the sky, or will it blow into the cabin and take my head off? I never heard of any such catastrophic failure on an MD-80, but didn't keep me from wondering. Standing in the TSA pre-check queue in Richmond, watching the single screener who was checking boarding passes and IDs have to sort of ping pong between the regular line and the pre-check line, got me also wondering, but this time, about what was keeping U.S. airports from installing the automated boarding pass checking gates that I had just passed through in Budapest and Krakow and would often pass through on my trips through Edinburgh. It seems like a lot of these sort of mid-sized European airports have got those all installed. I mean, now I get it. You know, those kiosks are only checking for valid boarding passes. They're not examining IDs, but there's got to be, something there that can improve TSA efficiency and the traveler experience. I mean, watching this poor woman, this screener kind of go back and forth, my mind fast forwarded to October of next year when the TSA starts enforcing the real ID requirement. I can just see all the time wasted arguing with people who travel maybe once a year and so didn't go through the additional hassle of getting a real ID compliant driver's license, and now they're stuck, not able to get through security. Note to self, don't book any travel in October 2020. Hey, and if you've got any travel stories, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio comment to comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account at Travel Commons or the website, like Leonard did, at travelcommons.com. So the only topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is street food in Poland and Hungary. You know, over-tourism is still a big topic in the tourism industry. Iceland seems to be cooling down a bit after the WOW Air bankruptcy. But then, you know, the photo in May, that famous photo in May of the queue to summit Mount Everest, now has become sort of the new icon of the problem faced there at Mount Everest and at places like Venice and Barcelona and Machu Picchu. And this whole sort of over-tourism, I mean, it kind of drives an interesting dichotomy then. Travelers chasing sort of the iconic Instagram picture, sort of a virtual souvenir for this pics or it didn't happen sort of age, while at the same time craving authenticity, which is, I think, where the current glorification of street food is coming from, wanting to experience something that you can only get in this place. And then, of course, post a picture of it. Now, you know, parking my usual cynicism for a second. So if you're queuing up at some food shack, hopefully with some locals, not just tourists, doing kind of the point-and-shoot ordering and then eating it there on the street, it does create a very specific moment in memory. I have to tell you for myself, I vividly remember buying takoyaki, which are basically octopus croquettes, from a street vendor in Osaka, getting into the queue for a food stall in a Beijing hutong, ended up being the only non-Chinese guy in that line, not knowing what I was going to get, but then being handed really this phenomenally fresh-cooked, crunchy scallion pancake, sending Andrew, our son, over to a vendor on the sidewalk in Hoi An, Vietnam, for black sesame soup. Always folding up a slice of pizza in New York City and some, you know, in the middle point of some bar crawl. And then, as we talked a few episodes back, slurping oysters on the Cancale seawall on the Brittany coast. Very, very vivid memories. And so while we weren't on a street food hunt in Poland and Hungary, our willingness, actually our desire to eat pretty much whatever we came across without any, you know, really without any filters, no worried about keto or paleo or gluten-free diets, that willingness led us really to some good street food, even though I have to tell you there were days that I really felt the need to double down on the statins. Probably the most memorable bit of street food came on our first day in Krakow. We landed around 9 a.m., took a taxi to the hotel, checked in, brushed our teeth, and walked out to the old square where I sort of trawled through the vendor stalls. I came, though, to a full stop at this small stand at the end of an aisle. An older couple had a huge pan over a wood fire. The pan had a metal divider down the middle. One half of the pan was frying onions, the other half sliced kielbasa. I watched a couple of people order and then stepped up. The man sliced a large, thick piece of bread off a round loaf, then spread a thick smear of lard with cracklings in it, then put down a layer of sliced kielbasa, and then finishing it off with fried onions, all for 30 zloty, or about $3.50. I don't know what left more of an impression, the size and heft of what he handed me, or the staying power of the layer of pork fat that it left on my lips, but It was great. I'll and actually, if you go to the website, the picture for this episode is the picture of that, is me holding that that stacked slice of bread. So then, after that, we walked, waddled straight from there to a small square behind St. Mary's Basilica for the Krakow Pierogi Festival, as one does in Krakow. There were about, I don't know, 20 to 30 stands selling their selections of pierogies. I'm not sure if pierogies are, you know, they strictly qualify as street food, but for this festival, they did to me. And I queued up really at the most popular stalls and did kind of the point and shoot ordering through most of the selection for each of the stalls that I visited. I ended up skipping the sweet pierogies, the chocolate and banana ones and the blueberry ones. They just didn't say pierogi to me. But I ended up with sort of 5 to 6 pierogies from each stand, from the traditional onion and potato to goose and duck and wild boar filled pierogies. I tried to avoid pointing to the Mexican pierogi at one stand, but somehow it ended up on my plate. It was a pretty full contact day one for us. I got to say, I needed a nap. Now, Chicago has a large Polish population, somewhere in the range, depending on the estimates and how you define Polish immigrants versus descendants of immigrants. It's somewhere in the range of 1 to 1.5 million Polish immigrants and their descendants in the metro area, which also, depending upon who you read, is the largest Polish metropolitan area outside of Poland. So in Chicago, we get our share of Polish food, and I wanted to try a few things that I recognized. The first thing we hunted down was a punchki, basically a Polish jelly donut. Now, in Chicago, Punchki Day is Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras, and you see punchkis everywhere, the grocery stores, the bakeries. So asking around, the consensus recommendation for a place to buy punchkis in Old Town was, and I'm going to butcher this this pronunciation because my Polish is lousy, Gorachy Punchki, or I guess the translation in English is hot donuts. So we rolled up there a couple of times during our stay in the Old Town there in Krakow, and I got to say we came away disappointed. Even the grocery store punchkis in Chicago were better. So, you know, minus one on that one. Now, that weekend, though, we were staying with friends in kind of the hills, the mountains, a couple of hours southwest of Krakow, down near the sort of the Czech and the Slovak borders. And so on Sunday, we went to our Karchma for lunch. And again, I'm probably mispronouncing this, but Karchma, near as I could tell, is sort of like a roadside pub or roadside restaurant. But this one, the specialty was potato pancakes made in a wood-burning oven. One guy, the owner, was running the oven, laying the pancake batter down in the oven, shifting them around with spatulas, managing the fire, making some of the pancakes flat while stuffing and folding others over, like sort of, you know, potato pancake quesadillas. Watching this guy was like watching sort of a kitchen ballet. And the product, what he put on a plate, just for us, was a straight up potato pancake, was the best potato pancake I had ever had. So he definitely, this guy definitely beat out Chicago on this dish. Now, when we then went down to Budapest, we got there on St. Stephen's Day, which is Hungary's biggest national holiday. It sort of is their national founding day, kind of like, you know, their version of U.S. Independence Day, the 4th of July. So after checking into our hotel, we walked over to the Buda side of the Danube, where there was a huge food festival. Now, the longest line was for the national cake, a slice of the national cake. Apparently, they do a special cake each St. Stephen's Day, which is kind of wild. That was just a very interesting concept to me. And it was a really long line because they were handing out free pieces of cake. And who does not like a free piece of cake? But I just didn't need a piece of cake. So we skipped it and went for the next longest line, which was freshly fried langos. Now, every culture seems to have some version of fried dough street food, and langos is Hungary's. Though langos is actually savory, a savory fried dough, not sweet. So it's not like, you know, you get the funnel cakes here in the U.S. with the powdered sugar over the top. Not like that at all. And this day that we were there, St. Stephen's Day, it was a hot day. It was getting up into the 90s. But, you know, here is this booth full of women hand stretching balls of dough into discs and dropping them into deep pans of hot oil for people who were then waiting 15 minutes or more in the hot sun for these pieces of fried dough. The fully dressed langouche was brushed with garlic and then topped with sour cream and shredded cheese. I got to tell you, coming off of that weekend in Krakow, I went for the light version, just the garlic. Now, a few days later, Irene and I took a 40-minute train ride up along the Danube to a town called Szentendre, a bit of an artist colony town. We hadn't been there in, I don't know, about 20 years or so. So I thought we'd check it out. You know, we thought we'd check it out again. And top of our lists of things to revisit was a little langouche shack tucked away halfway up a little staircase that goes up from the town square to the Catholic church, which is on top of a hill. I mean, the last time we were in Szentendre, we just tripped across this langouche place walking up to the church. You know, just a couple of people in a little shack frying up langouche. It took us a bit to find the staircase this time. It's about a person and a half wide archway next to a souvenir shop. The shack was still there, but it has now expanded, now with tables and a little courtyard, and it has been found. We stood in a queue of tourists for sort of 10 to 15 minutes, again, in a very narrow stairway, watching two women kind of crank out fried discs of dough. Now, I cringed when I saw people putting ketchup on their langouche. We just stayed pure with the garlic. You know, the last time Irene and I were in Hungary in 2017, we complained to ourselves about not being able to find good basic Hungarian food outside of the tourist traps. We saw lots of burger bars and pizza joints, especially in the Jewish quarter, the party district where all the ruined bars are. But now things seem to have been a little bit more diversified. Not far from Szimplakert, kind of ground zero of the ruined bar circuit, there is a place called Ghetto Goulash or Ghetto Gulyash selling, well, goulash and sort of other Hungarian basics like chicken paprikash. And even better, it looks like there's a bit of a chain called Langos that's open in the party district till 2 a.m. Fried bread and beer? I'm really not sure there's a better definition of street food. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Charles Cummins podcast number 155. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. And better yet, I hope you tell somebody else about it. Check out the show notes for pictures and music links. As always, you can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Alexa. You can ask Alexa, Alexa, play Travel Commons. Or I think it's Alexa, play Travel Commons podcast. Also, iTunes and Spotify. The links, along with the RSS feed, are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that is the social media section with links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. If you've already subscribed, appreciate any kind of reviews or likes on any of those sites. And hey, if you've got a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, to M. Peacock on Twitter, write them on the Travel Commons Facebook page, the Travel Commons Instagram site, post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. I really appreciate it. And until we talk again, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.